Okay, we'll finish off the last couple of overviews now. Next up, representing the Ubuntu project, we have Scott Remnant.
Hey, so I think most of you probably have encountered me before at some point or another along the way of free software. Currently these days, I'm a Ubuntu Development Manager at Canonical, running one of the two teams that develops Ubuntu there, and just going to give a quick 5 minutes for you on Ubuntu and Debian as a kind of collective, how they are. So, the first thing about Ubuntu, it's Debian unstable. If you're running Ubuntu, if anyone here is running Ubuntu, they are running Debian. It's Debian at the source code, mostly. We make changes to it, to fit in changes we need to make or want to make to it. But by and large, it's Debian unstable. So if you see Ubuntu running, then it means that person's also running Debian, just as that person's also running Linux. We chose Debian unstable because, quite frankly, it's the best platform distribution out there for deriving from. If you want to make a derivative distribution, Debian and Debian derivatives are the best starting point. It's got a great team of people, and we get everything we could ever possibly want from them. So, it's a good place to start. So why did we derive from Debian? Why not just use Debian? Debian is a great kit for making distributions, but it doesn't just work. So there have been like recent strides in the last couple of releases since Ubuntu came along, but in general, Debian is kind of, you have to know your computer, and you get a lot of options from it, and Ubuntu, we want it to just work. Part of this, I mean, one thing several people will complain about Ubuntu for is that Ubuntu does ship on our CD some binary-only drivers, which is part of this reason. It's the only compromise we make on free software. Otherwise, we are completely committed to free software and open source development. We ship binary-only drivers because we like a laptop to be a laptop and not a doorstop. I suspect a good proportion of the people in here have Atheros chipsets or the Intel 3945 chipset wireless or possibly a modem in there which doesn't work. We kind of like this stuff to work for people, so that's the reason we compromise on that. It's the only compromise we make in Ubuntu. We don't ship any non-free software. We don't ship any kind of non-free documentation or anything else that meets our guidelines. We only have a special restricted area for drivers which are required to make the hardware work, which kind of comes down to this just work philosophy. We make releases every 6 months. Part of the perceived problem with Debian when we started up was that Debian had not released in a very long time, and Debian releases are very far apart, which is absolutely fantastic if you're running a server distribution or you're kind of, you don't have a long upgrade cycle. We found the biggest clamor from users of normal machines was that they wanted far, far more regular releases, which is why we chose the 6-monthly release schedule. And our release schedule is the same as GNOME's, which is deliberate. We use GNOME as our desktop on Ubuntu, and therefore harmonizing our release schedule with theirs was just natural. We release beta about the same week that GNOME released their release, and then we do our final release a month later. So we kind of do that every 6 months. We've changed it once or twice to do kind of experiments with bug fixing, releases, and extra stuff like that. But in general, we made it every 6 months. In fact, after that, we even did a 4-month release cycle just to get it back on track so we could carry on where we were before. One of the things we felt was really important, we wanted to get a Linux distribution that we could give to everybody. And if your distribution comes on 12 CDs, if you have to download 4 ISOs just to install it, it doesn't work. We wanted it on one CD. Just one disk, we can ship it to everybody in the post. You can download an ISO and burn it for a friend, and they don't have to worry about which order they go in. You don't even have to write on it. Just one single CD to install it with everything else available on the internet. That was kind of a big thing for us. It's a desktop CD. The server world is interesting to some people, but not really for us. It's a solved problem in most regards, to be honest with you. I always probably get always shot down for saying this, but I think Debian is a much better server platform than Ubuntu because there's far, far more choice and flexibility there for the hardware. Ubuntu is for a desktop, really. We do all that. We consider the desktop first. Best of breed software comes on that CD. We hand pick one of each app. We pick a photo editor, we pick a office app, and we pick things like that, and we just put one of each on the CD. If you want different ones, once you've got the CD installed, that is, comes up. You can go and install it from the internet, which is fine. But, you know, the single CD does just literally, there's a live CD these days. If you boot it, start and you can do it, it's booted, it's a full CD. You can install that on your machine and then customize it to your heart's content. It's far easier to customize an operating system which is actually useful for the first minute it's installed than it is to spend a few hours kind of customizing it. Probably the last thing about Ubuntu and Debian is that everything we do in Ubuntu is available for Debian to take back if they wish. Every single code change that we make to Ubuntu source code is published as a patch to the Debian source code. These patches are available all the time on patches.ubuntu.com. The current active difference is always published on merges.ubuntu.com, which is the difference there is the merge difference is ready merged for people to take back if they want. Every time we make a change, it's emailed to the Debian package tracking system so that people can, the Debian package tracking system can subscribe to it. You know, we do try everything we can to let Debian take back the packages and take back the changes. But one thing we don't do is we don't push it back. We very, very, very strongly believe that Debian is a wonderful environment which kind of fosters innovation and fosters development of free software, and that should be left to do what it will. Debian works best if it can make its own decisions. It works best if it can develop in all its own directions. We really, really disagree with the idea of forcing Debian to do what we want it to do. If we want to ship, you know, we want you to go UDEB kernel 2.6 right at the start, there was no reason to force Debian to do that. They were still shipping 2.4 on their installers, which is completely up to them. We think, we really philosophically think that you know, trying to force people into things is not right. That's why we publish our patches and email them. That's why we don't try and upload them into Debian. Debian is far, far better able to make those decisions itself. And that was sort of it, just a sort of quick notes about Ubuntu and Debian.
Thank you. Next up, we have Daniel Black talking about the Gentoo project.
Thank you all. Like a couple other speakers, I got started writing my notes sort of about the beginning of this talk, so forgive me if they're a touch rough. And I won't put up my handwriting because it's horrible. Quick introduction, I'm a Gentoo developer and sort of have been since 2002. What I came in here to talk about is generally what Gentoo is and the questions that were how is it related to Debian and what are the cool things about Gentoo. So Gentoo is run by the Gentoo Foundation, whose principles are that it's a community driven distro by the community for the community. And it's also, the other principle is it's about choice. What this means is there are about 280 developers on our list, of which probably about 180 are active. Okay, Gentoo is a build from source distro. It was originally inspired by some of the aspects of FreeBSD in the way that you update a tree and then sort of select the packages you want. The original Gentoo, I believe, was based on Debian, although I barely see any correlation in its current form. In appreciation, I guess, of the community aspect of distros, one of the greatest inspirations for me was when I saw a bug report by a Gentoo, by a Debian developer in the Gentoo list, and I thought, wow, this is great that they're actually directly contributing to us rather than sort of supporting the upstream, which is, I guess, what every other distro really does, and it really shows what a great community that we do have within the Linux in general. Next page. The cool bits about Gentoo. You've generally got the latest versions of the upstream packages available. You can actually mix the stable and the unstable version. So if you want a unstable latest version of PostgreSQL, you don't actually have to make your entire distribution go to the unstable. It will actually work out the dependencies on its own and gives you that freedom, which is, I guess, part of the choices principle. This obviously has implications for release cycles. So When 2006.1 Gentoo release came out, my home system that was originally installed in 2002 actually had the same packages as that would have been on that CD. You've got options when you actually install the packages. If you want OpenOffice to actually support a MySQL backend, you can enable a use flag to actually enable that option. I believe Gentoo actually makes a great development environment, and some of the people that I've been talking have met today and last few days have actually sort of said that. What they like about it is you can actually change what package versions. If you're developing a package that uses, say, XML2, you can vary the versions of XML2 and make sure it works on all of them, and then hopefully it'll work for all the other distros as well. You can switch amongst the GCC versions, so you can switch from compiling on, say, a 3.3 compiler to a 3.4, up to like the 4.1 compilers. You can introduce your own C flags and LD flags and those kind of customizations into your build if you want to try something super fast that undoubtedly will break. The choices also mean you've got a fairly minimal install, as a couple of people I've met over the last few days found out, I guess, the wireless drivers and all the wireless tools aren't actually in the base install. And that's because it's your space, so if you want an extra package, you can install it on. You've also got the choice of, say, SE Linux, role-based authentication, RPAC. You've got embedded and UC libc profiles if you want a smaller system. There's a hardened profile, which I guess goes into like your GR security kernels and with all the GR security patches in that. It by default, all the packages have non-writable and executable pages in there else. So everything should work on a harder platform, and that's enforced by the kernel. It's got HTTP extensions in the compilers if you want. Something about buffer overflows and cooking and something well beyond my knowledge. You've also got a choice of multiple architectures like MIPS, PowerPC, Itanium 64 machines. And there's a whole lot of Indigo stuff and a lot of people working on far less common profiles. And you've also got a choice of different kernels. You can go with the vanilla ones, the Gentoo security ones. You can go with generic Gentoo sources, which try to give the user hopefully what they need. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, now we don't quite have enough chairs here, but the general idea for the rest of the session is to try to draw out some of these differences and what we can learn from different distributions. So what I'd really like to do is get reps from different distributions down the front, and we'll run around madly with a microphone, and you can throw questions. Yeah, there are chairs, but there aren't enough. So do we want two classes? Yeah, I think stand at the front. Yeah, it's up to you. If you want a seat, you can grab it, but just stand. Okay, so who wants to ask the first question? What we'll do is get both these microphones happening if they are both working. Okay, yep. Can we drop the volume on that? Is that okay now? Yes. Okay. So what we'll do is I'll run around the room. Who wants to ask the first question? No one. Okay. Do you want to just grab that and pass that around? Nothing. People answer questions. All right. Up the back. You're going to get me fit, aren't you?
What a sucker I am. Bernard, with regard to sit-ups, what's the situation with security support, formal or informal?
There's none.
That's a great answer.
As far as the security support is whatever security is provided by Debian, and officially that's none. As far as running bleeding edge software with security patches in it, obviously SID is ahead of the other releases in that regard. So yeah, I guess it's whatever the package developers have decided to include in the current package.
I'll ask a related question. What cooperation is there between distributions at the moment in terms of security issues?
Sorry, which distributions?
Any of them. Any general questions of the panel?
There's a secret cabal of distros that maintain a mailing list where we coordinate timely release of patches if people who discover security issues choose to share it with us. Admission to this mailing list is controlled. You can't get on it just because you want to. You have to be a provider of a distro that releases security patches. I'm pretty sure that Debian is on this list. If you have a legitimate reason to be part of it, like there's a Apache representation, there's FreeBSD, there's various things on there. That aren't exactly distros. And there's just well-known security people who spend a lot of time patching software, like, oh, yes, we really want that guy on there because he's going to help us. So that's how cross-distro security cooperation happens.
What do you guys think of a smart package manager?
So the guy who wrote Smart Package Manager, Gustavo Niemeyer, he actually works for Canonical. It's something we've kind of been evaluating for quite a while. I think at the moment it's an attempt to kind of, for those that don't know what smart is, it's a replacement for apt, which is able to make sort of apparently more intelligent decisions of how to fit upgrades and updates and changes to your software within it. It's also capable of supporting dev as a back-end, RPM as a back-end, and so forth. Our main kind of experience with it so far has just been in testing and kind of decisions. From an Ubuntu point of view, it's come up between Paul, the technical board, a couple of times, and our current stance on it has always been that it's an exciting, interesting development, but it offers nothing substantial over apt at this time, because while it can be demonstrated to do things a lot better in certain circumstances, we found just as many that it kind of didn't. So it's something we're kind of keeping an eye on, because it could be really good in the future, but right now it's not something Ubuntu is considering replacing apt with yet. But do you want, what's the Debian stance on it?
There isn't one.
There isn't one.
Anyone else?
OpenSUSE is pretty much the same stance. You can download it using RUG. But RUG is our standard, so that's what we choose. And in the end, the technical differences we see them currently is not that big to change. It also binds together with our enterprise strategy, really, and our standard Linux management product, RUG. So it'll be a hard time for us to replace it. But I personally use it quite a bit. I find it quite fast as opposed to other package managers. So I like it.
I would say on the package manager front, I think if we're going to do something, at least on the Red Hat side, I think we're going to do something a little more interesting than trying to remix how we do our software on the outside. I think the input side is more interesting. Like, how do you actually get contributions in? How do you actually get patches? How do you share information a little bit better? What other ways can you use to generate software packages? I mean, the Red Hat package manager is pretty old. It suffered from a lack of maintainership, although we fixed that, which is kind of nice. We actually got a real community around it again. But in terms of how we make things a lot better and how we get more people involved, I think those are the more interesting questions than sort of how do we get packages on your system more efficiently. That seems to be an area that a lot of people are working on.
Next question.
Yeah. I'm Andre, a Debian developer. And I'd like to get back to that thing that a few of you mentioned, and that is firmware with or non-free drivers and so forth. And I think James said, well, you know, essentially it boils down to freedom versus doorstop, you know, which sums it up very nicely in the Ubuntu fashion. But I'd rather quite often think that it's more like a dead end thing. The more you give in, the more you go and say, yeah, cool, you know, we got to get this stuff going and working and so forth, very important, the less you actually encourage manufacturers to open up their stuff. And I'm sure that all of you more or less would have a similar views, but may shrug and go say, yeah, but what can we do, which is exactly what I'm wondering. Is there any sort of like combined effort? Is there any discussion going on? Should there any discussion be going on in order to try and, you know, foster the opening of drivers and things, because that's a cross-distribution problem quite clearly.
Okay, I'll just answer kind of a couple of things from Ubuntu quickly. As to whether it's kind of the fact we do ship them, yeah, we do know it's kind of bad, but it is, on the end of the day, the user's choice. If the user goes ahead and buys a machine or a piece of hardware that cannot be supported by free drivers, that was their choice. If anyone here has a laptop like that, they did have an option to kind of buy it with free stuff, which would have been more expensive or more inconvenient. We see our role, instead of trying to dictate and prevent them from using their laptop, to kind of educate them on why they shouldn't be using it. So we're doing kind of stuff in our current releases to actually inform people they're using non-free technology and offer them even looking at going to the head of kind of doing evil things like actually giving them links to their alternate vendors' homepages where they can buy better products, which may or not be legal in some countries, we don't know yet. We also take the possibility of it's better for us to lobby at the vendor level. So we can, when we go to Intel, when we go to NVIDIA, when we go to people like that to do deals with them, that is the best way for us to try and deal with it. So we kind of have open relationships with several of those companies at the moment to try and kind of improve free driver support, while at the same time kind of offsetting that with still shipping the binary drivers. We think that when we've got a mass at the moment of the number of laptops, if we just turn around and say to Intel, and Intel's a bad example, they're actually pretty much free drivers now. But NVIDIA, for example, if we turn around to NVIDIA and say we will stop supporting you, they're going to shrug their shoulders and say, who cares? If we can have a third, a half of NVIDIA's market, and then turn around and say, we're going to stop supporting you unless you release your specs and your drivers, then we can start bargaining with them. So I think our point of view is that we have to get there first. I'm certainly aware of at least one or two efforts of cooperation with other distributions to try and do this, kind of do the same thing with them, and sort of lobby people to get their specs open and get their drivers open. In some areas, it's really successful. I mean, Intel have been great. They've, you know, we've pretty much gained the point where Intel really seriously believe now that open hardware specs is the way forward. So it's pretty good.
From an open source perspective, we actually found kind of like a way in between, which we believe is satisfies both kind of camps. Firstly, with actually our policy is that nothing is allowed to taint the kernel. Nothing proprietary is allowed to taint the kernel as such, and we would not support it as such. At the same time, we realize, again, that laptops and other hardware require binary drivers, and after you register OpenSUSE, for example, you'll actually get injected into your package management system, the URL pointing back to NVIDIA, back to API, where we, with them together, have developed some modules, drivers, that then can be downloaded from their side. So it's a very clever legal way to actually ensure that they distribute it, which makes it legal again. We still don't support them, so as such, once the kernel is tainted, the only support that's been given is obviously by the hardware vendor. And to enable that, we've actually created something I believe is very unique in the distribution landscape, and it is a driver process, which allows us to actually ensure that from one kernel upgrade to another, driver modules, like the NVIDIA one have to be upgraded. So one needs to be recompiled, as we all have to do it, you know, on occasion in the past especially. But with OpenSUSE, if you don't want to, you don't have to. You run that module in different kernels. So I think that's quite an elegant solution. It puts the legal side back to the vendor. We work very closely with the vendors to push them along. Intel's, of course, with their open source driver is kind of our favorite because we can ship it. And the other two, I think, will get there as soon as our position is, as soon as we reach 10-15% of the global desktop market share, I think it'll happen. I think they will recognize that, you know, probably their hardware specs, secrecy is maybe a bit too close. And if they want our support then, once we reach 10-15% of the community, I think they will change their tech.
Civix takes a much more grassroots perspective, I guess. We don't ship with non-GPL compatible code in the kernel. As was just mentioned before, it's we don't like to paint the kernel. What we do, though, we have one developer who hacks on the Mad Wi-Fi project, has half a clue about writing drivers. Just as a general example, I have a ZD 1211 as Zytel Vizel chipset wireless card that I couldn't get working with the ZD 1211 RW drivers, which are open. What do? I throw it in a package and send it up to him in Brisbane to make work. What I would like to see is particularly paid developers be able to focus a bit of time on either reverse engineering or being able to work on open source drivers for particularly popular chipsets. You don't necessarily need vendor support to do that.
So I want to talk to your point exactly. You know, we certainly in the Fedora project, we're very serious about not allowing non-open source drivers in there. To the point at which, you know, a lot of laptops don't work out of the box. That's a lot of frustrating to a lot of people, and I see a lot of brown circles on a lot of people's desktops. But at the same time, we still have enough market share where our experience has been that our ability to say no actually causes reactions, right? I mean, Intel's a good example, actually. We said, you know what, we're not going to ship that driver until you fix it because it's clearly not acceptable with a binary daemon associated with it, and, you know, maybe they're going to fix the firmware down the road, but our ability to say no had a real reaction inside of Intel. We could see them scramble a little bit to try and set their deadlines and try and get things done. So, you know, we take the opposite stance, I think, of a lot of people where we say, it's not good enough, you have to do better, and we've gotten reactions out of the hardware vendors as a result. It's nice being able to do that, and we have enough market share where we can do that right now.
Yeah, and I guess it goes without saying that the Red Hat Enterprise Linux release follows the same philosophy as Fedora. I wanted to follow Andreas's point about a new approach to driver packaging. I just wanted to congratulate Novell on their approach because Red Hat are adopting that approach in our upcoming release, and there is the promise that vendors who ship binary drivers, if that's their choice, can do so with a common source package between Novell and SUSE. So I think that's improving things for the commercial community that use Linux.
That download approach gives the chip vendors a count of how many people are downloading the device driver. This could be a good thing or a bad thing.
Actually, I just thought one interesting point to make as well. With Intel and AMD, the reason we've had a lot of success is because most things in here are running Intel or AMD chips. Linux has a huge market on their platform. I mean, we've got, you know, OEM deals and stuff with them and directly, whereas ATI and NVIDIA are still very much gaming market, which is not an area Linux has conquered yet. So they get most of their users as high-powered gaming machines, which we don't have. So they're not so interested, I think, at the moment in supporting us directly with OEM deals. We have a very large hope that that's going to change with ATI. Now they're merging with AMD, so they'll hopefully get some of the good stuff from that, but we'll see.
So Debian's approach is basically we're all for freedom and we don't really care about market share, and if users can't use our stuff, well, at least they get a free thing. So our approach is actually not even just to take the GPL stuff that Linus or the upstream kernel guys give us, but to actually remove the stuff we don't consider free enough from that. So the 2.6.18 update that's due to be uploaded any day now will strip the key span and a few other drivers out of
out of the Linux kernel because they have inbuilt firmware that we can't use or other binary blobs that we don't find acceptable. Beyond that, we've in the past had an issue with binary blobs of firmware directly included in the kernel source, and it took a year or two to actually get that taken into account by the kernel guys, but that resulted in a new interface being added so that firmware can be loaded in essentially user space off the disk and not need to be included in everyone's kernel hard-coded. So I think one of the things that can be good about a variety of approaches is that we can have some people saying that, yeah, we need everything to be free as possible, and other people taking a more moderate approach, and other people saying, well, we just need something that works because, hey, people need laptops that work. And we can take kind of all the approaches at the same time by just having a variety of distributions available.
Scott could give a brief introduction to Launchpad and how that might affect the community and the other distributions.
Okay, so Launchpad, it's a project by Canonical, which is one of the companies that also funds Ubuntu. It's not an Ubuntu project itself, it's put another project to the same parent company, just as BazaarNG is another one, and the Mythical Landscape is another. Canonical is a software development company, we do various bespoke projects. Landscape's goal is to be, not Landscape, wrong one, Launchpad's goal is to be a central collaboration area for open source. It's intended to be a kind of a bug tracking system, a distributions and development system. It's intended to be a source control system, a ticket support tracking system, specification development system. It's intended to be a central collaboration point. It's still very much in heavy early development. We're still playing around with ideas that we want for it. The person you want to find who knows a bit more about that would be Robert Collins, who's not around, unfortunately. It's, at the moment, quite famously, a piece of closed-source software. This is, you know, a bit akin to, say, for example, Google is a piece of closed-source software, because, while at the same time really funding open source. The reason it's closed-source at the moment is simply because it's in such heavy early development, and the general feeling amongst the developers in that part of the company is that there would be too much lost by releasing it now, and having five central single collaboration points for open source development, then trying to get one right before we release the source code to it to get things right. There's, as you can imagine, a lot of disagreement with this in the company. There are many people who believe that all source should be free where we have it. A lot of us on the Ubuntu team believe that, whereas a lot of people on the Launchpad team believe that it's, you know, until it's working, until it's a central collaboration point, having somebody just download it, set up another one, like it's happened with SourceForge in so many places, would actually destroy the concept it's trying to implement. It's a controversial thing, but at the same time, the company Canonical does plow a huge amount into free software. We've literally spent tens of millions of dollars on free software, so we have some black marks on it, but on the whole, we think we're sort of ethical on that nature. It will be, the source for Launchpad will be released. It has been committed to that happening. So when it's ready, it's not even 1.0 yet, so it's not anywhere near. And as anyone who's hacked on web apps knows, that the amount of source in a web app, which is 90% trying to generate content, is huge. And it's very, very hard to release source of web apps in a method that allows people to do anything other than set up an identical copy. I mean, Launchpad isn't even designed to be themed, so it would be almost impossible to set up a copy that didn't look like the real thing. I wonder if anyone else had some different perspectives on closed source web apps versus open source web apps, because I can see Chris.
No, I'm just kidding. I don't know. We've been doing open source web apps now for a while. Mugshot is a great example. It's huge, right? It's a tremendous JBoss-based application. It's been fine. I don't know. Hey, it's just your perspective and... whatever.
Yeah, I do. I personally believe we should have opened it at the start, but it's the prevalent view at the moment that we shouldn't. So it will be open eventually.
Okay, there's a question over here.
Is there any work on making and getting applications my Oracle of things certified against Linux standard space rather than a specific distribution.
So I'll just answer that one briefly from our point of view. We've obviously had quite a bit over the last year, of, especially with the DAPA release, of going to vendors to get certification. Our general feeling from talking to people like Oracle and IBM is they're not interested in doing that. They're interested in certifying against the distributions because at the end of the day, they're going to be getting phone calls and they don't want to have to deal with the myriad of different ways that distributions could possibly deviate from the Linux standards base. Instead, it's much easier for them just to deal with the distribution one-on-one. I don't know what anyone else's experience of that is.
One of the problems with kind of targeting the Linux standard base is that basically only Red Hat and SUSE have been the main supporters of it up till now, so you could either target the Linux standard base and deal with variations, or you could just go straight to Novell and SUSE. Ubuntu is now in a similar position with trying to get vendors to certify against them, so in future, it might become worthwhile to target the LSD, but at the moment, it's really not. Etch release will be the first Debian distribution that's LSD compliant, so even if you targeted the LSD in the past, you'd still be only really targeting RPM, and yeah.
It's really the culture of those vendors. If you look how in the past they used to do things, they always used to certify on a certain release, on a certain OS, and so on. So it's really their culture that we are all kind of in it, and so they talk to vendors because they want agreements, they want contracts, they want insurances, that obviously their support lines. That's very important for people like Oracle, for example, and others, that they have support lines, they can get their things in. And to do that, you need commercial agreements. I think that's one of the difficulties, is them not adopting the LSD standard as the main one. It's, you know, one that only us and two vendors really support it. But one is that their culture, really, culture of legal culture of contracts and so on, prohibits that pretty much. So they're much more concerned on being able to point the finger at the problem and then have a process to follow where it can be fixed within a certain amount of time as opposed to run around try to find some compliance in some general form. So, yeah, it's how those vendors work, really, and they're kind of all adapting to it.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think the LSD thing is a little bit of a red herring because it doesn't have that much to do with file locations. It has more to do with being able to deterministically say, you know what, we're not going to have I/O performance regressions. We're not going to change our kernel ABI for if you need a kernel module. It has to do with the ability to support customers. The only reason Red Hat, I think, is really well supported on Oracle is because we have a lot of market share. People know Red Hat Enterprise Linux really well. And we have the ability of the on-staff kernel engineers and our ability to test, and we know when things regress, right? I mean, we have the staff to be able to answer the questions and make sure that between a point release or a security update release that we don't cause every Oracle machine in the world to go backwards in time, right, in terms of performance, because that stuff happens in the Linux kernel all the time. And nobody should have any illusions about that. There are constantly regressions. The question is, can you catch them? Can you deal with them? Can you deal with the updates in a way that makes sense? So that's why Oracle picks a distribution or picks a particular kernel version or a release is because they know what the characteristics of that are and they know what how it's going to look down the road. That's what the promise that Red Hat can make as part of that, or SUSE or whoever wants to do it. So.
I'll ask a quick question. Last night I was speaking to Adam Kennedy, who's one of the CPAN maintainers, and he said that one of the big initiatives they have at the moment is setting up infrastructure or the processes to build distribution packages for every module in CPAN, which is 10,000 odd packages. One of the big issues they've faced is how to describe dependency information in a distribution agnostic way. So do you think that there is justification here or a reason for distributions to come together to try to solve those sorts of problems? Or is there an opportunity there that we could make it easier as distributions for very large projects like CPAN to interact with distributions?
I'll start with actually launched a build service, a public build service with OpenSUSE. which allows you to actually build RPMs and deep packages, Debian packages, for various distributions, so not just for Debian, Ubuntu, Red Hat packages and so on. That is for us really the attempt to do something like that and to give an open platform to anyone here to inject very generic packaging information, and the output is done then on our big compile servers to be able to produce then up-to-date packages for those and create YAM and other repositories then at the end. So it's an automated build system, a web application, open source, so you can download it, install it at home and create your own little build server. And the output is actually a variety of packages. So I can imagine that something like that could really help project like CPAN to very quickly develop packages for a variety of distributions.
I think it's a very good question, and I think it's a special case of the larger problem of namespace contention. And I think there's a great role for, or a great need for distros to cooperate in agreeing on issues of namespace, package names, dependency names, file names, and so on. So yeah, I see a great role more broadly in seeing namespace issues rationalized across distributions.
I'd say I would agree completely. We at Ubuntu already have fully thought of that, which is part of the reason we derive in Debian. It's a standard policy of how to name and derive your packages and to give dependency information, which is the principal reason we derive from them. We use all of their standard policies. If we ever package anything ourselves, we still follow Debian naming policies on this. So we do at least have a start there of a common naming policy between the Debian-derived distributions.
So for CPAN, a lot of that stuff's essentially been packaged already, or at least a lot of the stuff that is used in Debian packages or needed by Debian developers. And the standard naming for that we use is lib-whatever-perl. So basically, CPAN name is just in the middle of lib-perl. And that works for us. So, I mean, you could have automated mappings between different standard names, but...
You guys have a pretty flat namespace for dependencies, right? Yeah, because I think RPM is actually one of the things that RPM does pretty well is we have Perl-specific dependencies. So you have Perl and package names, like this requires this Perl package, so you have to go get it, and we automatically generate that dependency information too. So it cuts both ways too, but it would be pretty simple if you could, I think I was actually discussing this with him yesterday, which was what does it actually take, and it would be pretty easy to do it in our system, I think. Certainly just get it into Fedora extras, or Fedora when it becomes no extras anymore, but it's a mechanical thing.
I'd just say a general comment from anyone who's producing software that make your build system actually do a rough check on what's actually installed when you're doing it. That way the developers on any distro are going to say, okay, you do need that, rather than, it compiles okay, but then it needs it later. So, yeah, try to do the checks in the build system.
Yeah, any sort of automated tests you can add to your build system, they're all good.
Go see the How of Testing talk at some point as well. Unit tests for your package, make sure it's working correctly on the build, even better.
With OpenSUSE build server, you can, just do it. You don't have to worry. I'm kidding, of course, you have to worry. It's still packaging, it's not rocket science.
Yeah, we're out of time, so let's thank everybody on the panel. Before you run away, though, one very important announcement. You'll get a bit of a shock if you come in here after lunch, because we're actually doing a room switch. After lunch, we're going to be in Matthew's C, which is the same building, but just up behind us. Just as you come out of the back door, there are some stairs. Basically, go straight up those stairs, and that's where we're going to be. So we'll be back at 2 o'clock in Matthew's C. Thank you. Right now, we haven't got it confirmed. It looks like we might have a link up by VoIP from a guy in the US. The thing is that right now it's about 2 o'clock in the morning for him. So we're just confirming that he's actually going to be able to do it. It's going to... Yeah, we'll just keep phoning in. It won't annoy his wife at all. Sorry? Yes, we shall see. So, sorry, I can't give you an answer on that. Comment two, you shall see.
I don't know whether the built for people have it profiled or not. I know if they're interested in doing it, they probably have it partially done.
Well, really, you have a sort of profile.